Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings. On this segment of Bound by Honor, we are very happy to be visiting with Dayton Ward, author of numerous novels in the Star Trek universe, including such titles as Drastic Measures, Hearts and Minds, Headlong Flight, Trial by Fire, Elusive Salvation, Armageddon's Arrow, Peaceable Kingdoms, and From History's Shadow, just to name a few of his many works. Greetings, Dayton, and thank you for being part of our podcast this evening. Perhaps you'd like to tell us a little about yourself and what you do other than come up with brilliant Star Trek stories.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's always fun to talk about this stuff with people who are into it, like you all are. What do I do besides write? Not much. I'm really not much good at anything else anymore. My life right now is I'm a full-time writer. Wasn't always the case. I used to be a software developer. I was a software developer for many, many years, both in the military and in the private sector. And I sort of lost a passion for that. I'm sure it had to do with surviving multiple layoffs, but finally getting one of my own. And I just decided I was at a point where I wanted to try something different. So I took a chance on freelance writing full time, and that was 4 years ago. So far, so good.
Great. Okay, John, you want to kick us off with your questions here?
Okay. Let's start talking about Star Trek a little bit. When did you discover Star Trek, and what about it appeals to you?
Well, that's a question with any number of answers, depending on the mood of the day or what year it is or whatever. I watched Star Trek. I grew up in the 1970s. I was a young lad. I was born in 67, so I caught Star Trek in reruns after
school.
You
young whippersnapper.
Yeah. So I was watching after school and on weekends, and I caught the cartoon first run. And I was playing with the Mego action figures and building the AMT models and buying the Gold Key comics and coloring books and whatever else. And we played Star Trek outside at the local playground, that kind of thing. So Star Trek's been around me for as long as I can remember. As far as why I enjoyed it, I mean, back then when I was 7 or 8 years old, it was an action adventure show, and I liked watching Captain Kirk beat up on the Green Lizard. But as I grew older and I realized that there are so many layers to so many different episodes and stories, there's just always something new to discover about Star Trek. And I think that the show has proven over the years and with its different spinoffs that you can do just about anything within the framework of Star Trek. You can tell any kind of story. And I love that flexibility. And I love the fact that its overall message is a positive one versus a lot of science fiction today.
That's cool that you started off with the animated series, because you don't run into too many people who that's where they started. Even my brother, because him and I watched the animated series before we started watching Next Generation, doesn't even remember it. That's how young we were.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching it on Saturday mornings. My mother would let me watch it on the color TV in the living room. But for the reruns of the original show, I was banished to my little black and white TV. In fact, I didn't even know the original series was a color show until later.
Don't feel bad. I didn't know it was a color show, and I was watching it live.
Even though it said in color. It was the one exception to my you get home from school and you have to do your homework before you can watch TV rule that my mother had. I could watch the Star Trek rerun at 4 o'clock.
Well, see, I started out with the original series and was living in San Francisco at the time. I was about 10 years old. And I didn't come into it until later. As a matter of fact, the first episode I saw was Who Mourns for Adonais? Mm-hmm. And it was on at 10 o'clock on the coast. and my mother would not let me stay up until I talked and talked and talked and finally convinced her that I wouldn't give her any grief getting up for school the next morning, and so she let me stay up. Other than that, when it went into reruns, the original series, I was just like you, a 13-inch black and white TV.
Yeah, and then when we moved, I was born and raised in Tampa. I spent a little time in Tampa while my father was away, and then eventually, I was a military brat, so we bounced around, and we ended up back in Tampa at one point. So that became, you know, WTOG Channel 44 in Tampa. That's where I watched Star Trek every afternoon after school. And on Saturdays, sometimes they'd rotate it to the weekends where you got it paired up with Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and Space 1999, that kind of thing.
Ooh, that's a good lineup.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it seemed like every time I would catch the rerun on a Saturday was always The Savage Curtain. It's always the same. never failed, you know. It was like, and then I just remember the reception being so bad and that station being so underpowered that if I drove to, you know, if I went out to my aunt's place in Land O'Lakes, which is north of Tampa, the reception was so bad that I could hold the antenna, and then I had to decide, you know, do I want to watch Star Trek or do I want to listen to Star Trek? Because apparently it was going to be one or the other.
Cool.
So you had said that you started off as being a freelance writer. At what point did you specifically move into writing Star Trek, and how did that all come about?
I was writing stories for fun. This is, you know, a long time ago. I'm going to date myself pretty badly, but this is like in the early to mid 90s. I was writing for fun. I had discovered writing as a creative outlet, and I entered the very first Strange New Worlds contest that Pocketbooks was sponsoring, you know, the publisher of Star Trek novels. They had been at that point publishing since the first Star Trek movie, so coming up on 20 years. And so they had this contest for writers who had never been published, and you could submit your story and get it edited by an actual editor. And if you were selected, then they would pay you for your story, and it would get printed, and you get a contract, and you'd be like a real writer. So I entered a story, and they picked it. And then they picked it again the second year and the year after that. So after I rendered myself ineligible to enter that contest, because now I'm, quote, a professional writer, unquote, the editor at Pocketbooks, John Ordover, offered me a novel contract to write a Star Trek novel. So I said, sure, what could possibly go wrong? I've never written a novel before or anything longer than a short story in my life. This is going to be an awesome train wreck. And that was in 1999. And I have been doing it ever since.
So then I need to ask, did you have any formal training in novel writing or anything, or did you just hammer it out, learn how to do it?
I learned how to do it. I never took a writing course prior to any of that. I took writing courses after I sold my first story and started, I guess I got bit by the writing bug. I did take some classes, some community college classes and that kind of thing, and then read books on how to write and take notes from panelists at conventions and things like that. But I didn't go to college to learn how to write. I never took a prolonged course of education on how to write. I just sort of figured it out as I went.
Wow, so the talent was already there. Neat.
Well, that's arguable, but okay.
All right, well, this evening we mostly want to discuss the Hidden Universe Travel Guide, The Klingon Empire. Now, this is the second of two travel guides you have penned, if I have that correct, the first being about the planet Vulcan. This is a really unique book for fiction, I think, and for science fiction. I've never seen any before. Where did this idea come from?
I wish I could claim it, but it's not my idea, or it was not my idea. It was a brainstorming session between the folks at the publisher Inside Editions, specifically my editor Chris Prince, and John Van Sitters, who oversees CBS Consumer Products. He's the one who approves and reviews pitches for various Star Trek products, including books and comics and video games and any sort of merchandise you can think of with the Star Trek label on it. Someone came to him from Inside Editions, whether it was Chris or someone else, and posed this idea of these travel guides that were in-universe. And after it was decided that they wanted to do at least one with Star Trek, John Van Sitters recommended me to write the Vulcan one. So I got this weird phone call asking me if I was interested in doing something like this. And, you know, I've flipped through travel guides before, and I bought one or two every once in a while if we went traveling somewhere, but I had no idea what was involved in writing one of those things. So once we decided we were going to do this, you know, I went to the store and I bought a travel guide or two from a couple of different companies so I could get an idea how I wanted to lay it out. And we just, my editor and I, we discussed the approach and how to break it down. And I started combing Star Trek episodes for information on Vulcan, you know, specific locations and whatnot, and realized that there was nowhere near enough information to fill a book. So once I got those bare bone pieces out of the way, then I had to make up everything else. So, and then make it look like a travel guide. So the idea was that you don't read it front to back. You're not supposed to read it, you know, in order like that. You would flip through it like you would a travel guide.
Wow.
If you're backpacking or whatever it is you're doing, that was the idea. And it was a lot of fun. It was a different type of creative challenge than I was used to at that point.
Well, I know you succeeded on the Klingon Empire book because that is the feeling you get from it, including the side trips that you talk about within the book. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of the inspirations you got from cities and venues on Kronos? They've mentioned the first city in the episodes, but a lot of the other ones I don't remember seeing. So how'd you come up with them?
After I poured over every episode that had some, you know, facet of Klingon lore attached to it, where they might discuss a particular location, or, you know, like episodes like Birthright or Sins of the Father, where you actually see the first city and places like that. And there's really not a lot of and I hate to use this word, canon information with respect to these locales. So I was given a tremendous amount of latitude to look at other sources for ideas and inspiration. So I started delving into bits of lore from the novels and from the comics and role-playing games, you know, remembering locales that were seen in a particular adventure module or something like that, or referenced in a novel. So I would make notes of that. And then, you know, I still was left with a lot of stuff to figure out on my own. But the locations were inspired by any of those sources. And then as far as parallels to Earth, you know, I tried to look for the Vulcan guide. It was a lot easier. I tried to look at Vulcan as a very cosmopolitan area, depending on where you were. Like, so the big capital city on Vulcan, you would expect to see a lot of embassies. You would see a lot of representation from other planets. People have relocated there. They've they're expats from some other planet. So you're going to see a lot of those influences. Klingons, not so much, except for maybe in the capital city where they tolerate that kind of noise. But back, you know, you get out into the areas away from the main cities and stuff, and you expect to see more traditional Klingon culture. So I would definitely delve into different episodes and novels and comics, looking for references that I could then spin into something to make it sound like a location you want to go visit.
Well, I noticed that in reading the book, a lot of the ideas we get from Star Trek, scenes we see in Star Trek, you have interspersed in those other areas, which to me ties this whole thing, whole planet together as to one culture. Has anybody ever, you've got lots of maps in the books, mostly of the cities, mostly of the area. Has anybody taken your guidebook and come up with a map of the entire continent, I guess, planet?
I actually did have a map of the supercontinent, the entire landmass. Where you see where all those places are in relation to each other, and it was not included in the book. I actually drew out all the maps rough in myself by hand, and they were horrible. let me get that out of the way. I once had aspirations of being an artist, and the reality asserted itself very harshly and cruelly at me. But for purposes of helping the actual artists who worked on this book, in particular Livio Ramondelli and Peter Markowski, I drew up very crude maps on graph paper and faxed them. I scanned them and I sent them as PDFs to my editor Insight, who then gave them to the true artists who rendered the maps you see in the book. One of the maps that was not included in the Klingon guide, because it was something we talked about after not having it in the Vulcan guide, was a global map where you would see all the oceans and all the you'd see the landmass and where everything is. For whatever reason, it was decided not to include it in the book. I think they just ran out of space.
Yeah, that's really too bad, because I've personally gone out on the web and looked for maps of Kronos that other people have drawn to see if I could place your cities. in some cases I'm able to, because you've got enough detail that it fits those other maps. But it really would have been nice to know the juxtaposition of all the cities. Tell your editor that.
I still have the graphic somewhere on my computer that I sent to him that has that map. You know, with the caveat that it is not official in any capacity. I could probably share it with you guys. Just so you can see where my thinking was, mm-hmm. you know, at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I still have it somewhere because I never throw anything away, at least until a laptop dies on me or something.
That's why you're supposed to have a external drive so you don't lose that stuff.
I have an external drive. It's on there somewhere. So
before Sean, you jump in, one of the things reading this type of book like this is I like to go on what you might call a scavenger hunt. And as I run across a reference to an episode, it's like, oh, that's really cool. And, or something that I recognize. I'll tell you what, I really enjoyed your inclusion of Final Reflection by John M. Ford. And even more so Keith's book, Klingon Art of War. Those just stood out great. Did you work with Keith at all?
Not directly, but number one, I love The Final Reflection. It's one of my favorite Star Trek novels. It's probably, if not the definitive Klingon novel, at least the way Klingons were portrayed before the spinoffs began. It's certainly one of the best Klingon novels that we've ever seen as far, from Pocket. And The Klingon Art of War, an interesting story. I actually helped Keith with The Klingon Art of War. I was supposed to be the author of that originally. I was asked if I was interested, and we had even gotten so far as to put together a rough outline of where I thought I might go with the book. And then I had to step away from the project just because at the time I was still working full time and writing on the side, and there was no way I could make the deadline they needed. So I immediately recommended Keith to take the book. And of course he did a fantastic job with it.
Oh yeah.
I got asked at one point to contribute some material for the back of the book, the appendices you read in the back of the book. So I wrote I wrote a section about weapons, and then I wrote a section about a battle, the siege of Jaitlin Pass. And so that's that. So I think I repurposed that in the Klingon guide. I talk about that battle.
Okay.
Because in the appendix, I think I wrote about it to show how it illustrates the different precepts that Keith had laid out in this book. You know, how different facets of the battle exemplified or illustrated how that precept is valid. If you look on the copyright page of the book, if you go all the way down to the bottom, you might see something like, and special thanks to Dayton Ward for additional material. That's me.
That'll be neat because we are going to look at Klingon Art of War, and I've already been in touch with Keith, and he's going to join us for that one too.
I absolutely knew I had to include something about not just the bit that I contributed, but the book itself and the philosophy that he illustrates in the book. I had to include that somewhere. So that's why there's a sidebar about the Art of War in the guide.
Awesome.
A couple of things I like to mention too about I really thought it was interesting that you set an opera to the Gorkon series that Keith wrote and have the convention at the end of the book for Battle Cruiser Vengeance.
Well, I will tell you that ad at the back, if you look at it, I don't know if the joke translates very well, but I got called late one afternoon by my editor, who informed me in a panic that the layout had been done for the book. Everything had been, all the pages were laid out, all the art was in, and they were 2 pages short. And so I needed to come up with something very quickly, very easily, that could be done up and put in the back of the book now. Like, I got about 30 minutes to figure this out. So we jotted around some ideas, and my first thought was an advertisement of some kind, because it was an idea we had tossed around with the Vulcan book, but ultimately did not do. And then I got hit with the idea of revisiting, because I had mentioned Battlecruiser Vengeance earlier in the book. And so I said, what if in the Star Trek world there is an immersive attraction that is basically the Klingon Empire version of Star Trek The Experience, you know, the Las Vegas attraction.
Right.
And so that's where that comes from.
Yeah, I thought reading through the book, when I was reading through it, they must have given you tight word counts for every page to fit the artwork, the way it tightened. Yeah. and almost like the book itself was a painting, you know, words and pictures, but it was tight.
It was easier to write the Klingon book because having gone through the Vulcan book and learning how the art and the text were going to coexist, I learned to write more tightly as far as what would go on the page and how the art would you know sit side by side with it. The Vulcan book was a learning experience for me, working with graphic designers and artists and how to marry all that together. Going into the Vulcan book, I took all those lessons learned, so my writing was a little tighter. I edited a lot out of the Vulcan guide just because I was given a word count, but you get running. And next thing you know, you're over your word count by 10, 20, sometimes 25%. And then you got it. But, you know, it's easier to cut than to try to add. You know, and that's sort of always been my philosophy. I'd rather overshoot and then have to dial back than come up short and have to scramble. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to ask this later, but I think it segues right in right now. Kag has a Xeno Legion, which has lots of other Star Trek races other than humans and Klingons. Is anybody looking at doing further travel guides for some of the other planets, other societies within Star Trek?
I know there's been some talk about what another Star Trek travel guide might look like or what form it might take. And, you know, there's a couple of different tracks for that conversation. It's, you know, once you get past Vulcan and the Klingons, the list of races and planets that lend itself to a book like this by themselves starts to get short pretty quick. You could argue that maybe the Romulans are a candidate, but I don't know that we would have that same kind of success with something like the Cardassians or the Ferengi. As much as I enjoy writing about them, I don't know that they can stand in their own book. We talked about maybe, but it's also about, you know, how much they think they'll, how much they can sell the book. I mean, Klingon, everybody knows what Klingon is and everybody knows what Vulcan is.
That's fair.
Because that's the other thing. These books were not meant. I was asked to walk that line where it can appeal to hardcore fans, but casual fans at the same time, which, I was told, you know, don't treat it like a role-playing game, supplementary rule book or an encyclopedia or a formal reference book. Have fun with it. It's a travel guide. It's written for people who travel, so embrace that mindset, embrace that attitude. Don't poke fun at it, don't laugh at it. When I do make a joke or if I put an in joke in there, then it's done respectfully and it's because it's coming from me as a fan. But it has to appeal to the casual buyer. It's like, okay, you want it to be on the shelf and you want somebody's grandma to pick it off the shelf and go, yeah, that would make a great Christmas present for Tommy, the Star Trek fan, you know, that kind of thing. So it was an interesting balance to maintain. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think you did a great job of keeping that balance in both of them. I really enjoyed both of them. I thought it was great reading all the short stories.
And as far as technical guides, I know at least of a couple conventions that they've taken your book and actually done panels about Klingons at the conventions using your material.
I had no idea that was going on. That's interesting. Thank you.
They did it at Klingon Feast last year.
Interesting. I'm surprised. I didn't hear anything about that. I figured I'd have been stoned or something for doing something wrong. Well,
quite the opposite.
Well, I appreciate that. It's always fun to hear that that people are enjoying the book. I mean, in that kind of way. I mean, it's, you expect people to read it and then maybe write you an email saying how much they enjoyed it, but that's as far as it's going to go. I mean, every once in a while I get surprised when I hear like a college professor is using one of my novels as some sort of aid to teach their class. And I'm
Told him about your plans, Jim?
Well, I was just going to say, don't tell the guy that wrote this thing, but I'm planning on bolstering my Klingon culture panel with this.
Okay, you'll have to let me know how that goes. I'm curious to see how that goes. It means people are enjoying the book, which means I did my job. It's a lot of fun. I'd write another. Like I said, I don't know what form it would take. I don't know if we can get away with doing a standalone book for something like the Ferengi, but I don't know why we couldn't do some sort of guide of, you know, a handful of planets that have something in common, or you know, it's possible. I don't know.
You've got enough rules of acquisition there that you can make a book just out of those.
I wondered about that. Yeah, and I know that, and the other thing is the Hidden Universe umbrella title, that actually is Inside Editions. They have used that moniker to include travel guides from other franchises. Like, so there's one for Marvel, like a Marvel guide to the cosmos, which is told from the point of view of the Guardians of the Galaxy characters. And I think there's one, it may be out already, or it's coming very soon. There's one set in the Firefly universe. So it's a travel guide to the worlds of the verse. So it's the same, but it's all the same underneath that Hidden Universe umbrella.
Huh.
So yeah, that was their idea. I didn't come up with that, which I thought is cool, because that's a way to kind of, within that framework, I think that gives you some flexibility in terms of what kinds of books you can create.
I'm just thinking in my mind on that Firefly book, is the ink brown?
Nice.
Yeah. All right, Sean, you want to continue?
Sure. You've already talked a little bit about the guidelines that they set, but how much control did CBS exert in your creative process for this book versus other novels you've written?
Well, they didn't really exert any. They didn't really flex any muscle. I am fortunate that I have established a very good rapport with the folks at CBS Consumer Products. I've been writing Star Trek novels for years now. So we've gotten to the point where it used to be, if I had a question for licensing, I would have to send it to my editor, who would send it to the licensor, and I would hear an answer 3 weeks from now. Well, now the guy who runs CBS Consumer Products, John Van Sitters, he'll just pester me on Twitter if he wants to ring my bell. So that's how we've evolved that relationship over the course of literally 20 years now. Because he started off working, it was Viacom Consumer Products when he started. And I think one of the first things he ever did was read my manuscript for my very first Star Trek novel and provide feedback. So he's been doing what he's been doing about as long as I've been doing what I've been doing.
Oh, so you've had the same guy throughout all the buys and selling of the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah, and he and the other people in his office, namely like Marion Cordry and Paula Block, who preceded her, they're all fans of the franchise, and they're all protective of the franchise, and they know their stuff. They're not just casual fans. They are hardcore fans. And I sometimes will try to slip in things to get past them, and they'll like, they'll call me on it. No, that's not how that would have happened. So no, they know their stuff, and they're very protective and supportive of us. They're protective of the property, but they're supportive of us. So they help us, you know, by making it better. As far as the guidelines I had, I didn't have any real hardcore rules that I had to observe. I mean, nothing that I did wasn't already doing writing novels.
Yeah.
You know, stay true to the brand, stay true to the message, stay true to the franchise. The only things that they probably did was they may have dialed back my humor a little bit, because they encouraged me. That's the thing. They encouraged me to be very irreverent and humorous where the situation called for it. And as Jim has alluded in the earlier part of the podcast, I can be a little irreverent. I can be a little snarky when I want to be, and I do that on a frequent basis. I will make Star Trek jokes, knowing full well that the people from CBS can read what I'm writing on Twitter.
Wait a minute.
Let me do that. They know I'm doing it from a point of love, so they let me get away with most of it.
Wait a minute. You're doing a book on Klingons.
Right.
And you're being snarky?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Those things don't go together.
They are very tolerant of my antics, for which I'm very grateful. But no, my relationship with CBS has always been a great one. So I had very few rules regarding what to do, other than to, you know, lean into the fun that is inherent in the idea of a travel guide written by non-Klingons trying to make the Klingon homeworld and its various other planets interesting to potential travelers. And it was an interesting challenge. And I only recently found out about this, but the book, The Klingon Guide, won an award for graphic design by a group of people who hand out these things in the Midwest. And apparently it won a gold medal in the categories of travel and how-to guides or something.
Wow.
I forget what it was, travel or informational guides. But it cracked me up, because it's a travel guide for a place that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So it beat out similar books for real places that somebody else put together. So I'm sure that pissed off somebody.
Oh, boy.
But I thought it was cool.
It is.
And that's all.
That's like AAA giving an award to the technical manual for the Bird of Prey.
Exactly. You know, or whatever. Exactly. Or the Haynes manual for the Enterprise, you know.
Or the Chilton Manual Company publishing Dune. Oh, wait a minute. No, they did that.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say, Dayton, you are going to go on your dream vacation to the Klingon homeworld. Considering your book, describe what your ideal vacation would look like.
Well, I would probably go away from the main settlements, the big cities. I would go for one of the outlying provinces or regions somewhere along the coast, because what I really like to do, my ideal vacation, is where I'm sitting on a beach somewhere reading a book and I hold up my hand at irregular intervals and somebody puts a drink in it. That is my dream vacation. So if I can find that place on the Klingon homeworld, then that's where I'm going. Same answer for Vulcan.
Okay. Although I would be afraid of what you'd get served for a drink on Vulcan.
Yeah. You never know.
Yes, you do. It's tea.
We'll just go to Risa instead and call it that.
Now that needs a vacation guide.
Amen.
I have, you know what? You know how many times I have volunteered to write that guide, and I said, you know what? I should probably go to the Caribbean or the Bahamas for research.
Exactly.
They're not buying it.
You can write it off your taxes.
You got to do the empirical research on that. Yes.
Yes. To give it the proper authentic flavor, and they're not buying my story.
Imagine that.
I'll keep trying though.
Now, I know you talked about this in the book a little bit, but if you're on that ideal vacation that you talked about on the beach, getting drinks on, would you take the time to actually learn language, learn Klingon whole, or would you try to go as an American tourist? Do you understand me?
I would probably try to learn at least we're talking an era where universal translators are commonplace. So hopefully I'm able to communicate without sounding like an idiot tourist. I would probably try to learn enough language so that I could ask the basics. Where's the bathroom? How much do I owe you? That kind of thing. Please and thank you. That kind of thing. I spent a year on Okinawa, and I tried to learn Japanese, both written and spoken, and I failed spectacularly at both. So I don't know how my efforts would be trying to learn Klingon.
Oh,
I would probably get knifed in an alley. So,
I just couldn't resist the Mark Twain reference there.
I would probably do something to insult someone's house and then get knifed in an alley.
If you did the insult well...
This is true. This is true. He might give me points for originality or bravery or whatever. But
the worst you'd get is headbutted.
This is true. And I would probably lose that for sure.
To shift gears a little bit, what foreknowledge of Discovery's version of Kronos did you have going into this project, if any?
None. I wrote the book. Let's see. The book came out last summer. It would come out about a year ago, right?
Yeah.
It came out about a year ago, which means I would have written my manuscript as much as a year. In fact, I did write it. I wrote the first draft of the manuscript a year before that. So we're talking the summer of 2016. Summer 2016 because I had it with me when I was on a Disney cruise. I had a copy of the manuscript that I was red penning and fixing with editor's notes while I was on vacation. So I had the barest of information about what the Klingons were going to be doing in Discovery at that point. Because this is also the time frame where I had only recently learned that they wanted to have me write one of the Discovery novels. So, but they hadn't yet figured out what the Klingons are going to be. So I had very little to almost no knowledge of which direction Discovery was going to go. I did get enough assurances from Kirsten Beyer that they were not going to introduce anything crazy in terms of redefining Klingon. Well, okay, barring the makeup, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, but there were going to be no real huge deviations from the Klingon homeworld that we knew. And I think they ended up sticking pretty close to that. They didn't really show us much of the Klingon homeworld, even in those last few episodes. So,
I just had a strange thought when you said you were editing the book on a Disney cruise with what Disney has added to their cruises now of having Darth Vader looking over your shoulder while you're editing a Star Trek book.
I was editing a Star Trek manuscript while drinking rum and Coke out of a BB-8 cup or a thing, a big flat a thing that looks like BB-8 with a straw stuck in his head. That's what I was drinking. So, yeah, because Disney had definitely Star Wars'd up its cruises by the time we got on board. Mm. So, yeah, I was crossing the streams there a little bit.
So, we're curious, and I'm sure many of our listeners are, for translating to or from Klingon Whole, what resources do you tend to use as an author?
Well, it's funny you say that. What happened, we tried to limit the use of the native language as much as possible for fear of doing something wrong with it. And as it happened, I came up with several placeholder names for different things, whether it was restaurants or bar names or locations or whatever, with the full intent of seeing to it that they were properly translated. Okay. And at some point in the process, that didn't happen. So we end up with a manuscript that has, you know, incorrect translations.
Okay.
And so I reached out to a couple of folks from the Klingon Language Institute to help me with that. And I gave them a big list of stuff that I would look for which I sought proper translations. And they helped me tremendously. I owe a huge debt to these individuals, these guys. They completely helped me unscrew that.
Awesome.
So it was a KLI, and it was sort of like I screwed up. We all screwed up. Let's go talk to these guys, because if anybody can fix it, they can. They not only did it, there was three guys, and I'm going to pull up their names so I can give them their proper due here. Hang on a second.
One may be listening tonight.
Yeah, he might be listening in.
They were totally cool from the first moment I reached out to them. They were very supportive. I gave them a list of things that I needed translated. They even brought in Mark Okrand at one point to get his judgment or his viewpoint on a couple of the phrases that we were trying to translate. It was an amazing collaboration. And these guys are awesome. If I could just frigging find my file here, because I'm horrible. No, well, I mean, it's been a year now and I've forgotten stuff. So
oh, yeah.
I want to make sure I get it right. So
it's been more than 24 hours. I would have forgotten.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't tell you what I had for dinner, and that was an hour ago. So tell you what, I'll pull up my mail. So, but anyway, yeah. So that's how we did it. That was how the language translations happened, and could not have done it without those gentlemen. Hang on. All right. So if you have another question while I'm digging, feel free.
Okay.
We were kind of wondering if there's going to be a revised edition to the travel guide based on Discovery, or did you feel that the vendors that you describe in the book are similar to the vendors that we actually end up seeing in Discovery?
That's a great question. I don't honestly have an answer for that. The reason being is because I don't know that they do that. I don't know that Inside Editions goes back and revises any of their past titles. I guess what'll happen is if the book has sold well enough and there's enough of a demand for it, and if Discovery starts adding in a lot more to the lore, you know, a lot more to Klingon culture than we've seen so far, then there might be a call for it. That's a great question. It's just not one that's been discussed to this point. All right, let me rephrase that. Nobody's talked to me about it. Now that might be something that my editor at Insight has put a pin in to revisit, depending on any number of factors. Not the least of which is how well does this book sell. My understanding is that it sold pretty well though, along with the Vulcan Guide. So I would absolutely welcome that opportunity if they let me.
So maybe when we get this thing published, you need to give your editor a link to this podcast.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, one of the guys one of the guys that I worked with, in fact, he was the lead on this. His name was, and I'm going to probably destroy his name, Felix Malmenbeck. And he was one of the first people that I reached out to. And then a couple other folks I reached out to on Facebook. But he was sort of the lead guy. He was the guy that I took most of my questions to. And then he filtered it to the other members of his little group that he formed to kind of help me out.
Well, KLI was very influential in getting the language right for Star Trek Discovery, up to the point where I think it was Robin Stewart was actually giving audio recordings to the actors to let them hear how the words were supposed to be pronounced.
Sure. Okay. And I finally found my other email. It's Chris Lipscomb and Andrew Miller.
Chris is listening.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, good. Thank you again, Chris. those guys were all awesome. All three of them were awesome. When I explained the situation, they were eager to help. They were eager to step in and help me out. It was a fun way to end that project.
You kind of already answered this, but at least in regards to the Discovery aspect of it. But actually, one of the questions that Chris wanted me to ask was, is there going to be, are we going to see a printed release of the revised edition with the corrected Klingon in it?
There was supposed to be. It all depended on the publishing schedule and how many units sold and what the demand was for a reprint. I was told that there were plans afoot for a second printing, but I don't know where they stand, to be honest with you.
And he'd also asked about, I forget the wording up, but it's like you release just like the pages to the ones that are wrong so somebody could fix the book itself. Does that make any sense? I forget the word. I was trying to look for it.
Like just the pages themselves, like in a loose format.
I don't know.
I think what happened was Insight, at least in the beginning, I know that the ebook version of the book had the corrected version, had the correct edition or the with the corrections in place. I don't know if the physical. It was too late for the physical copy for the first edition. I know that. But Chris, my editor, Chris Prince, my editor, mentioned that they were already talking about a second printing and that these changes would be factored into that. But I don't know. I don't know where we are with that. What I do know is that so far as I can tell, the book has not yet hit remainder sales for those who don't understand, remainders are when you go into Barnes & Noble and there's that section at the front of the store that where all the books are heavily discounted.
Yes.
Those are basically what the publisher has sold to book retailers at bulk prices, so that you can buy them for $6 instead of $16. So far as I know, the Klingon Guide has not hit that level of sales yet. The Vulcan Guide I have seen in places like Half Price Books, where I've seen a half a dozen copies at each store or something like that. So I don't know if the Klingon book has made that yet, and it may not be because there was a second edition and the sales are doing well. I need to check into that.
And unless your Klingon in the book is really, really bad, according to Mark Okrand, it could just be a different dialect of Klingon.
Well, he's very gracious, and I appreciate that on his. he's being very kind to me.
He talks about it in his second Klingon book. I got it right here. Klingon for the Galactic Traveler.
Okay.
Mispronounce a word, it's just a dialect.
There you go. Well, I'll take that. I knew that. I didn't even know that he was going to be involved at all in any of this until Felix mentioned him. He said we had a couple that we just couldn't figure out on our own, so we went to Mark. And of course, at the time, my head was in some other book that I was working on, so I said, Mark who? And then I realized, as soon as the words left my mouth, I'm like, of course, Mark who? I know exactly what he's talking about, idiot. So, because my brain was already two or three books down the line when all this happened. So, it's neat when all of that comes together and works to make it better.
This is a podcast for Klingon books, book reviews type things. Can you recommend other titles to us that maybe we should look at?
Other Klingon-centric titles?
Very much so.
Yeah, your Klingon-centered titles.
My Klingon-centered title. Yes. Oh, so you're asking me to pimp my own stuff.
Exactly.
I was getting ready to pimp out a couple other people.
Well, that's okay. We can use them also, Jim.
Pimp all you want.
We've already talked about the Final Reflection, and we've already talked about the Klingon Art of War, which are both excellent books for different reasons, obviously.
Our first podcast was The Final Reflection.
And if you're old enough like me that you bought the old FAFSA role-playing game, back in the early 80s, then you know that a lot of stuff you read in Final Reflection, there's some tie-ins in the role-playing game supplements to some of the stuff that John Ford came up with. Let's see. As far as my own work with Klingons, my very first Star Trek novel is called In the Name of Honor, and it is a title that puts Captain Kirk working with Koloth in the movie era. They are working together to determine whether Starfleet officers are being held on a Klingon prison planet for a number of years where they've been thought to be dead. And it's a bridge between Star Trek V and Star Trek VI. So I sort of had the idea that I could take us from Kirk is pretty cool with the Klingons at the end of Star Trek V to Kirk is utterly pissed at the Klingons at the beginning of Star Trek VI. I thought there was a story in there on how that shift happened. So that's what I tried to do. And it's also worth mentioning that it was written in 2000. I wrote it over 2000 and 2001, and it came out in January of 2002. This is before the Star Trek Enterprise, the TV show, tackled the idea about why the Klingons have ridges and don't have ridges and then have ridges again, you know, in Star Trek lore. So I actually took a stab at a reason why you see Klingons with ridges and Klingons without ridges, and why certain Klingons you've seen both. No spoilers, though.
Okay, here's something to crack you up. Okay, I write a sci-fi blog. On Sunday, April 21st, 2013, I posted a book review for In the Name of Honor by Dayton Ward.
Okay.
And it was positive.
Okay.
So,
I appreciate that.
The last line of my review says, there is no downside to In the Name of Honor.
Thank you. I mean, I've looked back at it once in a while because it was my first novel, and it has all the problems you would expect to find in a first novel, despite the best efforts of my editors to bail me out. I like to think I've improved since then, but it's still a favorite of mine because it was my first. It also has the distinction of being the very last original series novel that had a number on it.
Oh.
You know, they used to have the numbers, the numbering, like Star Trek, the motion picture novelization was retroactively numbered with number one. And then they would, every time a new Star Trek novel would come out, they'd put a number on it. So
yeah, this one was 97.
Right. And that's the last one that carried a number. I killed the numbering. Thank you. You're welcome. well, the reasons... I mean, there are pros and cons to having those numberings. I mean, I'm a big reader of old. I grew up reading books like Mac Bull and The Executioner, you know, those men's adventure novels. And they're all numbered. Casca, the Eternal Mercenary, they're all numbered. And there was a decision made at Pocket Books to dispense with the numbering because it was beginning to make them feel kind of cookie cutter. Like we were just cranking out a Star Trek novel every month because it was a new month and it was time for a new Star Trek novel. So there was a way to try to get away from that way of thinking. Like every book should be its own event kind of thing. I read a lot of Star Trek novels growing up, and there was a period there where they all kind of felt formulaic. You know, they were all just sort of very safe, and they didn't get to push the boundaries of what you could do with the format very far because, you know, there were TV shows in active production, and the novel writers were limited in what they could do. We enjoy a much greater degree of latitude. Not that we can do anything crazy. I mean, like I'm not going to marry Kirk and Spock off or anything like that. But the list of things we can't do is much shorter than it was 20 years ago, even 15 years ago. And the folks at licensing are very supportive and give us a lot of leeway when we come up with ideas. In terms of how to push the boundaries of what you can do with the Star Trek format.
Neat.
And that's why you get things like the Vanguard miniseries and New Frontier and things like that.
Can you discuss any future projects you're working on and when we can look forward to seeing the next Dayton Ward Star Trek novel?
Well, you will be able to see the next Dayton Ward Star Trek novel in April of 2019. I am currently writing a new Next Generation novel. Nice. It's called Available Light, and it picks up where my last Next Generation novel left off. It was called Hearts and Minds. It came out last summer. I pick up where that one left off, and I also pick up after David Mack, who's my friend and fellow word pusher, He dropped a big bomb on the Star Trek table last summer with a novel called Control, which is basically the exposure and the destruction of Section 31.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And Section 31's vast, vast, long list of sins is exposed now, including some stuff that Picard got mixed up with over the course of novels that we wrote several years ago. So all that's now come home to roost, and they laid it all in front of me and said, here, write a book. figure out how to fix that. So that's what I'm working on now. And then as far as other Star Trek, the other Star Trek book that I will have out the same month is a fun book from the folks at Inside Editions. It's a much more humorous book. I created a hand-to-hand combat manual that explains how to do all of Jim Kirk's fighting moves.
That's amazing.
It's called Kirk Fu, an introduction to the Final Frontier's most feared martial art. And it will show you 12 of the most famous moves that Kirk pulled during the original show. So like his flying leg kicks and his double fist punches and all these crazy, you know, jumping off the wall to land on the Andorian and that kind of thing. And it's all illustrated. And I took as a cue old school military style hand-to-hand combat manuals to do this little step-by-step illustrations.
Hey, John, it sounds like a good panel to run down there.
Yeah. So I wrote the text completely straight. Like the joke is that it's completely straight, and the illustrations show you just how ridiculous some of this stuff is.
Okay, I'm heading over to Amazon to put in a pre-order. Just shut up and take my money. Just take my money.
It has the distinction. It'll be my first ever hardcover release, so I'm pretty proud of that.
So now a thought I had was, if you're working on finishing up a new next generation novel, do you have any insights on the new Jean-Luc Picard series that CBS announced?
I have no more information than everybody who's... I mean, I have no more information than what's been made public.
Well, so, I had to ask.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's being done by the same people, by some of the same people who are involved with Star Trek Discovery, and they brought in some other writers as well. But Kirsten Beyer, who is one of the folks on Star Trek Discovery, is the co-creator of this new Picard concept. So, and given, you know, that it's set 20 years after Nemesis, which is actually 12 or 13 years after what we are doing in the novels right now, because they've given us the leeway to take our adventures beyond the events of the final movie. I suspect we'll be having a conversation at some point to try to figure out where the books, how the books
are going to tie into the series.
Yeah, how they do that, how we best do that. I'm actually looking forward to that conversation. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. But as far as details, I mean, my understanding is that their writer's room just opened up within the last week.
Oh, wow.
I have no idea what they're doing or what their progress is or what their timeline is or anything. But given what we do with the books and given Kirsten's already acknowledged role as a sort of liaison between the shows and people like me who write the books, I suspect we'll be having a conversation.
Great.
Can't wait. It's going to be fun.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Last question for the evening. Is there anything you would like to share with our audience about your work? How they can follow you, how they can get in touch with you, or any future things you're releasing other than outside of Star Trek or anything like that?
If you want to figure out what I'm working on from day to day, or because I keep a fairly frequently updated blog on my website, DaytonWard.com, that's also a portal of sorts to my social media platform, where you'll find my Facebook page and my Twitter handle and Instagram and links to stuff like what I do on the writing columns I do for StarTrek.com and things like that. So if you want to find out what I'm working on from day to day, that's the best place to go, DaytonWard.com.
All right, then. Well, Dayton, I want to thank you for joining us on the podcast this evening. And wow.
It's been fun.
It is.
Yeah. Oh, it has been. It's been fun. I really appreciate you guys having me on.
So, yep. And, hopefully we'll tap you to come back in the future. I'm sure eventually we'll be reading that first novel you wrote, number 97. And we'll be coming around to that and maybe want to talk to you then.
Okay, great. Sounds great. Hopefully I can remember enough about it.
Read the book.
Yeah, I should probably read it.
There you go. Okay. For Bound by Honor, I am Judge Jim.
Jorn.
Devon.
And join us next time on Bound by Honor. Now, Dayton, you got to join. You got to join us in a kapla. Ready? One, two, three, kapla.
Kapla. Kapla.
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!